I know what they look like, Shenton. I was there.
Yes, but... I think it's the GSK.
Griffin looks at him. Shenton has his full attention for the first time.
GSK?
Golden State Killer. Convicted for 13 counts of first-degree murder and 13 counts of kidnapping, but was believed to have committed more than 50 rapes and over 100 burglaries in California between 1974 and 1986.
Shenton looks more confident now.
The facts of your attack match up to the murders of Lyman and Charlene Smith. The killer entered through the bathroom window. He tied them up with cord from the curtains. Shenton pauses. He raped her, then beat them both to death with a log from the woodpile.
Shenton hesitates, then looks at Griffin.
I don't think you were supposed to survive, Sarge.
Griffin swallows hard. He looks at the information Shenton has put in front of him. He remembers the light dazzling him, the gun shoved in his face. He remembers the utter helplessness of being tied up as he listened to the screams from his wife in the other room.
But there's one thing that's different.
Griffin manages to clear his throat.
Go on.
The shoes. For the other home invasion rapes, the shoe marks found at the scene match an old-style Adidas trainer, a hexagon print, same as the GSK. But the ones found outside your bathroom window, they're different.
Griffin tenses.
Have you found a match?
Not yet, but do you think it's deliberate? Or did the killer make a mistake?
Follow it up, find out, and tell Elliot, he says.
Shenton gets up to leave.
How do you know so much about this stuff, anyway?
He notices Shenton's face colour.
I studied it at university.
Griffin raises an eyebrow.
I have master's degrees in criminology and behavioural psychology. I did my dissertation on the effects of child sexual abuse resulting in serial murder.
Griffin takes a deep breath in.
Tell Elliot that too,
he says at last. Chapter 29. Kara puts her key in the front door and listens. Inside she can hear screaming, high-pitched wails, followed by shouting. She pushes the door open. The house is in chaos. Toys litter the floor of the living room, the TV still on, a Lego Ninjago movie playing out on the screen. Noah follows her, closing the front door behind him. The noise is coming from upstairs and she follows it. The bathroom is flooded, towels scattered across the floor. She picks up her daughter's jumper, then gathers up the rest of the clothing.
Mummy!
Her daughter pokes her head out of the room, then runs to Kara. She bends down as her daughter charges against her, wrapping her arms around.
You're home, she says into her chest. Will you read us a story?
Her daughter looks over her shoulder, spots Noah standing at the top of the stairs, then lets out a squeal of delight.
Will Noah read us a story?
Kara smiles. She knew she'd be sidelined the moment they spotted Noah. To Kara's surprise, the first time Noah had met them, she had discovered there was no accent Deacon couldn't do. No funny voice he hadn't perfected. He'd have the kids in gales of laughter, rapt as he read their latest favourite. Tilly grabs Noah's hand, then drags him into the bedroom. Kara leaves them to it for a moment, putting the kids' discarded clothes into the laundry basket, picking a towel up and using it to mop the water on the floor. She folds the others and hangs them on the rail. She turns as she hears soft footsteps coming up the stairs, surprised to see Lauren still there.
Thank you for staying, she says to her.
Lauren smiles.
It's no problem. I didn't have plans.
Kara nods. The two women stand in the hallway for a moment. Lauren pushes her long blonde hair behind her ears and Kara feels slightly awkward. She wants to tell her to go home. She wants this time with her family alone, but thinks she might be being rude when Lauren has put herself out to help them today. They both listen to Noah's voice coming from the bedroom, starting on the story. She smiles as he speaks in a mock Cockney accent, then in deep Scottish tones. The door opens and Rue comes out. Rejected again, Kara says, and Rue smiles.
As always.
He puts his arm around her and plants a kiss on her forehead.
How was your day?
You don't want to know.
She hugs her husband, enjoying hearing the happy giggles of her daughter, laughter from her son. She can imagine them, snuggled up next to Noah on Josh's bed, clean and warm in their pyjamas.
How's Tilly?
She asks.
No vomiting since. Eaten some toast for tea, so all looking okay. I'll go and get dinner on, he says.
Are you staying?
He asks Lauren.
Say no, Kara wills silently.
Thank you, but I should be going, Lauren says. But I'll come and help tidy up. Kara hears Rue's protestations as they both go downstairs, telling her she should put her feet up.
I don't pay that woman enough, Kara thinks, feeling the familiar flash of guilt.
In the bedroom, Noah is sitting on Joshua's bed, her son next to him, looking at the pictures in the book as the story progresses. Tilly is sitting on the floor, and Kara joins her, sitting cross-legged, pulling her daughter into her lap. She leans forward and puts her nose into her daughter's hair. It smells of strawberry shampoo. Tilly drinks her milk and stares at Noah, completely absorbed in the story. Kara looks up at Noah. For the first time that day, he has a smile on his face. He's enjoying reading the book, receiving undivided attention from her kids. This is an aspect to Noah that has always surprised her, this softer, paternal side. She would love Noah to find someone, to fall in love. The second story comes to an end and Noah stands up, giving both kids a goodnight hug, leaving Kara alone with them. Into bed now, please, Kara says as the kids mess around together, eventually settling under their duvets, Tilly going next door into her own room. She hugs her son and kisses him goodnight. She stops in the doorway after she's turned the light off, just making out his shape in the darkness, feeling a swell of love. She hears the click of the front door as Lauren leaves for the night, then Rue climbing the stairs and going to say goodnight to Tilly. She would do anything for her family. She wonders if she should give up this job, do something more stable, or 9 to 5, then dismisses the thought. She knows she never will, then thinks, why would it not be enough? Rue comes out of Tilly's bedroom and joins her in the hallway.
All quiet, he whispers.
She nods and he goes in to say goodnight to Joshua, as she does the same to Tilly. She's already half asleep.
Mummy,
she says as Kara goes to shut the door.
Hmm?
Kara turns back, the light from the hallway casting a glow over her daughter.
Are you winning against the monsters?
Kara sighs.
I'm trying my best, she says at last. Get some sleep, Pickle.
She closes the door behind her and stands in the hallway. Downstairs she can hear the deep laughter from her husband, then Noah joining in. Even in such domestic bliss, she feels a heaviness to her body. She knows that at the moment she isn't winning. She isn't winning at all. In the kitchen, the table is laid and tempting smells are starting to waft from the oven. Rue stands at the kitchen counter, a knife in his hand, the blade a blur as he chops the carrots. Kara stops in the doorway. He finishes, tipping the vegetables into the boiling water, then spots Kara watching. He throws the knife in the air. It spins once and he expertly catches it by the handle.
What are you, 12?
Deacon scoffs from where he's sitting at the table.
Showing off to your girl?
Rue holds the knife out to Deacon.
You want to try?
He says. Deeks, I'm not blue lighting you to hospital with a macerated hand because you're trying to prove yourself to my husband, Kara says. And Noah puts his hands out in front of him.
I know when I'm beaten, he laughs.
The oven beeps and Rue goes to it, transferring food from the oven to their plates. It's a bizarre mix, spinach and ricotta cannelloni in a tomato sauce, perfect slices of beef Wellington, Dauphinoise potatoes, all leftovers from the restaurant. It's one advantage to having a husband working strange hours as head chef. Meals you would normally pay £20-30 for, served up in your own home. They all eat. Deacon seems ravenous and Kara wonders when he would usually cook for himself, if ever. Rue tells them about his latest sous-chef, a delicate French girl reduced to tears within the first hour.
"She should come to work with us for a day, then she'd have something to cry about," Noah says with his mouth full.
Rue looks at Kara.
"I saw you on the news." He pauses. "It's a serial killer."
Kara nods slowly. She takes a sip from the glass of wine in front of her.
"It's looking that way. Nate worked out the pattern."
"How is he?"
"I should have said hello while I was there."
"Sunshine and light, as always,"
Noah says sarcastically. Kara frowns at him.
"He's okay. Back with us, for the time being, anyway. I'd rather have him getting under my feet at the station than mouldering away in that basement."
Kara looks up as she hears a little voice shout from upstairs. Rue pushes his plate to one side.
"I'll go," he says. "You're still eating."
Noah watches him leave, then glances at Kara. She catches his eye.
"What?"
she asks. Noah looks down at his dinner and has another mouthful.
"Has Lauren got a boyfriend?"
he asks at last.
Kara frowns.
"I don't think so, no."
"Why? Are you interested?"
She isn't sure what Noah is getting at. Noah takes a swig from his beer.
"She just seems a little..."
he pauses.
"Over-familiar with Rue."
"They've known each other a long time."
"I know, it's just..."
he scowls.
"It's nothing."
"Spit it out, Deeks."
"When they went out to the car, I saw her put her hand on his arm. And it was there, I don't know, a bit too long. And when she saw me watching, she removed it."
Kara shakes her head.
"It's nothing, Noah. I know what you're doing. Just because we see bad shit every day doesn't mean everyone's at it. There's no more going on between Rue and Lauren than there is between me and you."
Noah stops and looks at her.
He holds her gaze just that little bit too long, and she looks away.
"You're right. Forget I mentioned it," he says at last.
They finish their dinner in silence. Rue comes back downstairs and sits at the table.
"Everything okay?"
he asks, looking between the two of them, puzzled. Kara forces a smile.
"Of course."
Noah takes a final swig from his bottle of beer. He picks up their plates and carries them to the sink. Kara follows him with the other dishes.
"I should go," he says.
He won't meet her eye.
"No, Noah, stay,"
she protests, but he shakes his head.
"I'm sorry, I'm just worn out."
Rue gives him a hug and a manly clap on the back, and Kara walks him to the door. He pulls it open, picking up his jacket, then turns back.
"Kara, forget what I said. I shouldn't have mentioned it," he mutters.
He pats down his pockets, pulling out the usual packet of cigarettes. He puts one in his mouth.
"Deeks, I'll give you a lift, please,"
Kara pleads. It's pouring down, puddles forming in the road. She knows he'll get soaked in seconds, but he shakes his head again, lighting the cigarette.
"I'll be fine. I need the walk."
"At least take a raincoat."
She holds out one of Rue's and he takes it, putting it on, then striding down their road, head down, pulling the hood up against the rain. She remembers the conversation with Libby in the bar and wonders exactly what is going on between her and Noah. How exactly he feels about her. She feels Rue put his arms around her shoulders and she leans back into his chest.
"What was that about?" Rue asks.
Kara turns in his arms and reaches up to kiss him.
"Just the investigation, wearing us all out."
She rests her face against his jumper as he closes the door.
"It was good to see you at work today,"
she says, closing her eyes for a moment.
"I always worry about disturbing you."
"No, it was nice to be reminded of the good things in life."
Her husband pulls her closer for a moment and she feels him kiss the top of her head. Then she looks up at him.
"Bedtime?"
she asks. He smiles. She knows he's in no doubt as to what she's proposing.
"Bedtime,"
he agrees.
Chapter 30. Griffin arrives home. With a loud bang of the door, he dumps his bag on the table, then takes two pills out of the packet and throws them in his mouth. Jess is sitting on the sofa.
her feet tucked under her. She's had a boring day. Slept, got showered, dressed, ate lunch. She hasn't dared leave, knowing people are out there looking for her.
"What happened?"
she asks. He looks up quickly, then frowns.
"Nothing," he says. "Nothing at all.
Something must have..."
"Nothing, okay?"
She jumps at his shout, and he sees her reaction. His jaw tightens. Then, quieter, he says,
"Just a lot of routine police stuff, Jess. No leads. We're no closer to finding this guy."
Then, without another comment, he digs in his rucksack again and pulls out a mobile phone.
"I got you this,"
he says, and throws it across the table to her. She picks it up and looks at it quizzically.
"Burn a phone," he says. "Untraceable. Thought you might want to call your daughter."
A sudden excitement comes over her. She looks at the phone, pressing the screen into life. It's shit and basic, but it's a lifeline. She stares at Griffin.
"Thank you,"
she says, starting to cry again. He looks uncomfortable at her display of gratitude.
"Whatever," he replies. "Just don't be too long. I've blocked the number, but you never know."
She stands up, moving away and sitting on the sofa. She looks at the phone in her hand, then inputs her mother's mobile number from memory. Her breath catches in her throat as the phone rings, then cuts to voicemail. She redials.
"Hello?"
On hearing her mother, anxious and uncertain, Jess starts to cry again.
"Is anyone there?"
her mother repeats.
"Mum,"
Jess eventually manages to croak.
"Jess? Is that you?"
"Yes, it's me, Mum, but be careful, please."
"Where are you? How are you?"
Her mother's voice becomes a dramatic whisper.
"Come home now. Enough of this messing around."
"Mum, I'm sorry, I haven't got time to argue. Can I speak to Alice, please?"
There's an audible sigh.
"You always were headstrong,"
her mother says, as if Jess has been caught being rude to a teacher rather than fleeing arrest for murder.
"Here you go."
There is a rustle and a bit more whispering, then a voice, high and on the edge of tears.
"Mummy,"
her daughter says. Jess feels a rush of relief. Emotion catches in her throat, but she manages to keep her voice level.
"Hi, sweetie. Are you okay?"
"Where are you, Mummy? Where's Daddy?"
Jess pauses.
"I'll be home soon. I've had to go away for a while, but Grandma and Grandad will look after you."
"Okay. Can we watch Frozen when we get home?"
Jess steels herself again. There's no home to go to. No Frozen DVD.
"We might not be able to go home for a while, sweetie," she says. "But Grandma will let you watch Frozen."
"Promise?"
Alice asks.
"Promise. I love you, Poppet. Can you pass the phone back to Grandma?"
"I love you too, Mummy."
Then another rustle as the phone is passed back.
"Mum, you haven't told her about Patrick?"
Jess asks.
"I..."
her mother starts.
"I thought that was her mother's job, that she'd need you with her when she found out."
Jess nods, swallowing.
"Thanks, Mum,"
she manages to say before she hangs up the phone. She can't bring herself to say goodbye. She feels tears welling up again behind her eyes, then anger building. All this emotion, all this crying, however justified, is not achieving anything. She's made a promise to her daughter now, to be back soon, and that's what she needs to focus on. She stands up and Griffin snaps his fingers at her, gesturing towards the phone. She passes it to him and he opens up the back, pulling out the SIM card, then breaking it in two. He sees her looking at it, watching her salvation being destroyed.
"Do you want them to trace you back here?"
he asks, and she shakes her head. Griffin throws the pieces in the bin, then walks over to the bed and slumps down on his back, his hands behind his head. Jess watches him. She wonders at what brought her here, to this flat, this man,
and to this insane situation. She should leave. Nav's right. She should hand herself in. That would be the sensible thing to do. But when has that ever applied to her? And something pulls her towards the mystery. An invisible cord headed for destruction. She's always found solace in the darker things in life. Those true crime documentaries. Those murderers and outcasts making her feel less of an aberration. Her whole life she's been fighting for the desire to be normal. A desire to be whole, somehow. To feel what other people feel. But now everything has been stripped away and she's alone. She doesn't feel that pretense. For the first time in her life, the macabre makes a perverse kind of sense. And Griffin's a part of that. Are you hungry? She asks.
No.
Tired? He shakes his head.
I feel like I'll never sleep again. All the time.
He flutters his hands above his face as he stares at the ceiling.
Just things going round and round. I just want to actually do something.
Jess doesn't speak, but slowly gets up from the sofa. She stands by his feet at the end of the bed. She feels a flush. Nervousness after what happened last time, but also excitement.
What do you want to do? She asks.
He opens his mouth to speak, but stops as she takes her t-shirt and jumper off in one quick movement. He raises himself up off the bed on his elbows, watching as she wriggles out of her jeans until she's standing in front of him in her underwear.
What do you want to do? She asks again. Jess.
Griffin. Shut up and take your clothes off. He hesitates for a moment, but she's aware something has shifted between them. He won't turn her down now. Sure enough, decision made, he pulls off his shirt and jeans. She takes the rest of her clothes off, then gets onto the bed, straddling him. He reaches down and in one quick movement removes his boxer shorts. Then he pauses, their eyes meeting. His hands go up to her waist and she can feel the light touch of his fingers on her back. Neither of them moves. The room is quiet. Jess can hear rain falling outside, dripping down the gutters onto the pavement. She holds his gaze. She moves back slightly, waiting as he reaches behind to the bedside table, swiftly opening a foil packet of a condom and putting it on. Then she raises herself up and onto him. She sees him take a deep breath in, then again as she starts to move. His hands are still on her waist, but he lets her do what she wants, moving slowly. But then something switches in him. He can't hold back anymore. He picks her up, her legs going around his waist, and he shoves her against the wall. She can feel the rough brickwork against her back. She knows it's a bad idea, but she likes it, and he pushes into her hard. His head is still buried in her neck, and she pulls him up to face her. She wants to kiss him. She wants to feel his lips on hers, to remember they're human, they're alive. But he pauses, as if questioning what they're doing.
Don't stop, she says. She kisses him, and he thrusts into her, harder this time.
She slips slightly, their position changes, they shift, together, him resting her on the edge of the large wooden table, his fingers digging into her bum. She grips his shoulders, moving with him. She's not thinking anymore, except about this, about the feeling of him. She can feel the sweat on his body, the rough of his stubble on her neck. This is what she wants, she thinks. Afterwards, they lie on the bed, passing a cigarette between them. As the room grows colder, he pulls the duvet across and Jess watches the shadows, headlights from the cars outside flickering across the ceiling.
You can't always use this to solve everything, he says after a while.
Use what?
Sex. This.
He uses the cigarette to gesture to her naked torso. She's quiet for a second. Are you complaining?
No,
he says.
Fuck no. Just at some point you're going to have to work out a way to make yourself feel better without resorting to sleeping with someone.
He pauses.
Or what you were doing last night.
She doesn't like what he's saying, but his manner, the bluntness, catches her off guard. He leans over her, stubbing the cigarette out in the ashtray on the bedside table.
It's not a criticism, he adds.
He stays propped up on his elbow, watching her through the darkness.
I'm not judging. You're not so different to me. Better looking, maybe, but inside we're the same. Just trying to get through the day.
She stares up at the ceiling. Griffin, she starts slowly. She needs to tell him. She owes him that, at least. She takes a deep breath. He's going to think I'm a freak, she thinks, like most people do when they find out. But she doesn't care. For some reason, she trusts him. I have a condition called congenital insensitivity to pain, she says. Griffin turns in the bed to face her, and she meets his astonished stare. I can't feel any pain, she finishes. He pauses.
Nothing at all, he asks.
I can sense hot and cold. I can feel touch and sensation, but no pain. No. She still itches. She is ticklish. But no stinging. No agony. No hurt. At least, not the physical kind.
So that's why,
he starts, gesturing towards her head, and she nods.
Sounds nice, he adds, after a moment.
It's not. She wasn't diagnosed until she was 6. By that time, she'd bitten off the tip of her tongue, had more fractures than she could remember, and social services had a file. She used to jump off the top of the stairs, tumbling carefree to the bottom. Hold her hand over candles, watching the skin blister, then burn. Her parents were driven to distraction. She was in a cast almost constantly until she was 11. When kids at school found out, they would punch her to test if it was true. Later, her response was to fight back. Bloody disputes she always won. As she got older, she worked out the warning signs. She's supposed to regularly check every inch of her body for cuts or bruises, any sign that something might be off. Internal bleeding is one of the biggest worries, her chest filling with blood, bursting her from the inside. She'd be dead before she realised. But she's always been too careless about it, too reckless. She explains all this to Griffin. He just stares at her. He seems to be thinking.
So, how do you know you haven't got a brain hemorrhage? He asks.
I don't. The doctors would have said.
You might.
I don't. There's another long pause.
If you keel over and die, I'm just going to dump your body in the woods somewhere, he says at last, with a small smile. Deal?
She nods. Deal. He rolls over in the bed onto his front, punches the pillow a few times, then slumps down face first onto it.
But I meant what I said, he mutters into the pillow. You can't keep doing things to yourself.
She hears his breathing slow as he falls asleep. People have said the same things to her before. But coming from Griffin, it feels different. Her husband used to chastise her every time there was an incident with the razor. I don't understand why you keep on doing this, Patrick said once. Is it attention-seeking? Are you trying to kill yourself? It was neither of those things, and it seems that Griffin tacitly recognises that. Patrick never had. On their wedding day, Jess had overheard a conversation.
She's too good for you,
his best man had been saying. You're batting way above your average. Patrick had laughed. It was late in the day and too much alcohol had made him glib.
Never hurts the career to have a gorgeous woman on your arm,
he had replied.
And you have no idea, mate.
Jess watched him do a circular movement with his finger next to the side of his head.
Mad as a hatter,
he had laughed. She'd felt the hurt, but she'd known he was right. She'd never mentioned it to her husband. That day she'd resolved she would get better. But it got worse. No amount of therapy worked.
Nothing changed. Until her house burnt down and her husband was murdered. Still naked under the duvet, she moves next to Griffin. She curls her leg over his, bare skin against skin, and he mutters slightly in his sleep, draping his arm around her. Maybe, she wonders, taking in his warmth. Maybe the key isn't getting rid of the crazy. Maybe it's finding someone just as broken, who understands.
Chapter 31. He holds a knife in his hand, blade facing forwards. It's large and sharp. Slowly he carves a piece of flesh out of the apple and eats it. He relishes the thought that there's traces of blood on the blade, that he might be consuming some remnant of his victims. It's cold down here. He's strung a single light up in the corner of the room, but the bare bulb is dim and the glow barely stretches to the bottom of the hole. But he can see her eyes, staring up at him. Two white circles, red-rimmed, shining out of a dirty face. Digging the pit in the basement had been hard and back-breaking, but he'd known it was necessary. It isn't big, about 8 feet deep, muddy, wet. It rained last night and the bottom filled up with about a foot of water. She'd begged him again, standing there in the mud. She'd said she was cold. She'd pleaded with him to let her go, said she'd let him have sex with her, she'd do anything. The thought made him angry. He would have her if he wanted to, not when she said it was okay. He'd fucked her already when he'd first got her here. Hands tied, she'd struggled, pleaded, kicked. But her fight had only spurred him on, his punches landing square on her face, silencing her. And the hopeful look after? She'd thought that was it, that he was going to let her go. That look soon changed when he dragged her down here, shoved her into the hole. To shut her up, he'd found a long plank of wood and hit her with it. Reaching down into the pit, he'd struck her over and over again. She'd dodged him at first, but once he'd got a good blow to her head, she'd been dazed, cowered at the bottom in the mud, and he'd been able to really go at her hard. He can see those bruises now, the scabs dirty, bleeding and raw. He can hear the rain again, outside. The hole's only going to get worse. He cuts another piece of the apple and puts it in his mouth. The house is perfect. It had sat empty for years, claimed by the council after his father's death, and left to rot. Much like him in that children's home. Slowly, the other houses were abandoned around it. Nobody wanted to live near the site of a double murder, let alone in the house where they took place. Nobody but him. "It won't be long now," he says to her, and she looks at him again, eyes pleading. He throws the remainder of the apple into the pit and she goes after it, the dirty, starving animal that she is, her chains rattling as she scrabbles in the water. He watches as she finds it in the mud and eats it, his lip curling in disgust. He'll be glad to get rid of this one. She's no more than a piece of property to him right now, but the reality of facing this stinking, shit-filled, muddy pit every day isn't something he's enjoying. But maybe... He looks at the electrical extension cord, its ends stripped bare. Perhaps he'll enjoy this part. He holds the insulation on the cord, just up from the bare wires, then reaches over and plugs the other end into the wall. He moves her chains closer, and she sees him, the cable in his hand, and the metal wrapped around her wrists and torso. She looks at the water around her feet. "Please," she starts, but the words are snatched out of her mouth as he applies the electrical current. She screams. Her body spasms and jerks, then falls into the water. He smiles. Yes, maybe he will enjoy this part after all.
Day 5. Friday. Chapter 32. Friday and everything moves on. Everyone is back in the incident room, no hesitation. All the detectives know there's a job that needs to be done. Kara sits with Shenton, reviewing evidence collected from the Dahmer crime scene. Fingerprints and blood work still aren't back, but the lab have forwarded photographs of the other exhibits collected from the flat. Toby slowly moves through the images on the screen, looking for anything worth following up. Kara sees Noah arrive for the day. He raises a hand in acknowledgement to her, slipping a polo into his mouth at the same time as starting a conversation with one of the detectives. Business as usual. She turns her attention back to the screen. More rubbish from the bin, a wrapper from a Mars bar, a scrap of green paper, a car park ticket. She points. Blow that up? Shenton zooms in. It's small, barely worth mentioning. Pay and display down one side with a date and time and a set of 6 digits. Toby points to the numbers.
Probably the location of the ticket machine, he says. What's the chance of finding CCTV from that area?
Worth checking, Kara replies. He makes a note and moves on to the next image, a letter, some sort of spam mail, to the resident of flat 214, written across the top. Then more paper, photographs of mess and rubbish. Shenton frowns and makes a quiet growl under his breath. Kara looks at him. Problem? She asks. She knows this sort of police work is monotonous, but sometimes it's the only way to unearth a lead.
No, it's just...
Shenton pauses and Kara stares at him.
Look at this mess. All this rubbish, this litter. It's not like him.
Him?
The Echo Man.
He looks at Kara and she notices a red blush creep its way up from his collar. He knows he shouldn't have used the name, but she lets it go.
Look at everything else he has done, he continues. He takes the right tools to decapitate those bodies to the Kemper scene. But how did he get home? There must have been another car. Same with Manson. Same with Dahmer. He's organised. He's planned. He's clever.
You have a theory, Toby? Kara asks.
Everything he does is deliberate, right?
Kara nods her head.
So this...
He points to the mess in the photo on the screen.
Is deliberate, too. There's something here.
Kara looks back at the photo.
There's so much stuff. So much rubbish.
Perhaps it's just another aspect of Dahmer's flat. Dahmer was messy, so he has to be too. Toby turns back to the screen and zooms in on the photo. She sees him examining it closely.
Shenton, she starts, and he looks back at her. You know about this, right? About these killers?
I know a bit.
You know more than a bit? Do us a profile.
Boss?
You know, psychological profile of the killer. What makes him tick? Who is he?
Kara's not sure if this is the right move, but since Marsh won't release the budget for a proper psychologist, how can it hurt? They could ignore it, after all. Shenton pauses.
I could.
So do it.
Kara nods at him, then looks up as Griffin appears at their desk.
She's here,
he says to Kara, and Shenton looks up eagerly.
Can I go with D.S. Griffin?
He gasps with the enthusiasm of a new puppy, and Kara sees Griffin roll his eyes. He doesn't want to do this interview with Shenton. Kara knows that. But then a little bit of mentoring might be just the development her brother needs.
Griffin, take Toby, she says.
But then Shenton seems torn.
But the profile,
he stutters, looking as though he might cry.
Go, Kara smiles. Your psychological insights can wait an hour or so.
Griffin gives Kara a glare, then sighs, defeated.
Come on, then.
Chapter 33. The witness has a strong Southern American accent. Returned from visiting relatives, she says, the crime scene tape gave her quite the fright. Her hands flutter at her crepey, mottled neck. She seems more excited than scared. Griffin issues the standard warnings for the voluntary interview, and she signs the paperwork. Brassy blonde hair, makeup layered on with a trowel. Her perfume fills the small room, almost making Griffin's eyes water. He hasn't got much hope for the interview, but she's the last neighbour on the list, living in flat 215.
"And you say you've never met the resident of 213?
Griffin asks. Next to him, Shenton is already being annoying, busy scribbling notes on a pad, seemingly trying to capture every part of their conversation despite the fact it's all being recorded. "Knocked on the door a few times," she confirms, "to complain about the smell, but he never answered." She taps her bright blue nails against the tabletop, the noise grating on Griffin's nerves. "Good thing, too, he was a depressing-looking guy." Griffin's head snaps up.
"You said you'd never met him?"
She nods. "Not met. He never said hello. Just saw him the once going into his flat."
"And could you describe him for us?"
The woman shrugs and Griffin suppresses his impatience.
"White? Black? What was he wearing? You sure he was male? Tall? Short?"
She frowns. "Yes, a guy. Tall. Hard to say anything else. He was wearing all black. Black trousers, black sweatshirt, sneakers. Hood pulled up over his face." Griffin stands up. He gestures for Shenton to do the same.
"How tall? As tall as me or like my colleague?"
The woman stands up in front of them. She considers them both. "Like him," she says, pointing to Shenton. "Same build as him, too." They all sit down again. "You're a big bloke, ain't you?" she adds, coyly. Griffin ignores her flirting.
"But you didn't see his face."
She shakes her head, another gust of perfume wafting his way.
"I said hi, but he didn't turn. Just went in next door."
"I'm sorry,"
Shenton says, tentatively.
"Next door?"
"Don't be sorry, doll," she twangs with an oily smile. "Not your fault."
Griffin looks at Shenton. He's staring at his notes, running his finger across the page.
"But you live at flat 215?
Shenton asks.
"So this guy was going into...
apartment 214, right?"
"Fuck,"
Griffin mutters under his breath.
"Ma'am,"
Shenton says calmly,
"we need to know about the resident of flat 213.
"Oh," she sits back in her seat, crossing her arms over her chest, bangles jangling.
"No, can't help you there."
Griffin and Shenton walk back, downhearted. Kara meets them in the corridor. "Anything?" she asks. Griffin shakes his head.
"Thought we did for a second. She had a bit of a description of a bloke going into the flat, but it turns out it was 214.
Kara's face falls.
"You been to see Marsh?"
She nods.
"Usual message. Get it sorted."
"No pressure,"
he says sarcastically.
"None."
They walk back to the incident room together, but then Kara stops them in the doorway.
"Flat 214?
She asks. Griffin nods. She drags them over to Shenton's desk.
"Toby, pull up that bit of post we had earlier."
She directs him, pointing to the photographs on the monitor. "There! The one they found in the bin of 213.
214?
Griffin reads out loud. He looks at Kara. He knows that expression.
"What are you thinking?"
"Toby, who lives there? Pull up council tax records."
He does as she asks, expertly navigating the system.
"D'Angelo,"
Shenton says, excitedly, gesturing at the screen.
"Joseph D'Angelo."
Griffin looks from Kara to Shenton and back again. They're smiling. Kara raises her hand and Toby slaps it with a high five. Griffin knows that name. Until recently, an unknown. Ex-Navy, an ex-cop. And now?
"Joseph D'Angelo,"
Shenton repeats.
"The Golden State Killer."
Kara picks up the phone. "We've got to get into that flat."
Chapter 34. Well, I don't know. Kara stands outside the block of flats with Griffin, the same block of flats as the day before. The white scientific services vans are still parked outside. Kara knows the SOCOs will be there for days yet, piles of evidence to log and take away. The landlord stands next to them, nervously wringing his hands. He's potentially killed 11 men, Kara says.
Not Joe. Joe's a good guy.
You've met him?
No, not actually met him, but...
He glances upwards. Kara follows his gaze. The window of flat 214 seems to be covered with something. They can't see any blinds or curtains.
How did you come to rent him the flat? How does he pay?
Griffin asks.
He put a note through my door about a year ago when I advertised. Cash every month, right on time.
The landlord's gabbling now.
And you took identification?
No, he...
He stops, looks down.
He paid me double to keep quiet. Ignore the usual paperwork.
Kara and Griffin both glare at him. Chastened, the landlord holds out the spare key.
I'm sorry, how was I to know he'd be a serial killer?
Kara takes the key and they walk towards the main door.
How do you want to play this?
Griffin asks.
Call in armed response.
Kara frowns.
That could take hours.
She looks at Nate. There's no way he's there, right? I mean, still staying at the flat while the place crawls with crime scene officers and cops.
Seems unlikely.
So let's just go and look around. What's the worst that could happen? Griffin stays silent. They walk towards the door of the block of flats where Kara remembers vomiting in the flower bed just 48 hours before. She's glad Nate didn't reply. She knows the answer. More bodies? A serial killer with a gun? But they can't waste any more time. They pass the open door of flat 213, blue and white tape across the entrance. Kara picks up two new white crime scene suits from the pile and hands one to Nate. They both put them on, along with the shoes and gloves. They keep their hoods down, masks in hand. She pauses outside 214. Ready? She says to Griffin. He nods. She feels reassured knowing her six-foot brother is there with her. She knocks. There's no answer, so she puts the key in the door. Her hand is shaking. It takes two attempts. Then she turns it, pushing it open. Inside, it's dark. The flat feels cold, the air enclosed and stale, but she doesn't detect the same intense smell of decay as they had from the flat next door. Even so, she puts the mask on and pulls the hood up. Next to her, Griffin does the same. The wooden boards creak under their feet as they go into the first room. It seems to be a bedroom, although it's completely empty. No carpet, nothing on the walls, except a patch of damp in the corner of the ceiling. The single window is covered by newspaper, grey light shining through. She's disappointed, then registers the absurdity of the feeling. No dead bodies are a good thing, surely. Kara turns around to Nate, narrowing her eyes. He shrugs and points to the next door. Neither of them speaks. A bathroom this time. Avocado green sink and bath. White toilet. Grey grime coats every surface. Curling lino on the floor. But nothing. They look at the last door.
Kara, Griffin starts.
If we've wasted our time, then so be it, she replies. What will we have lost?
He opens it, and Kara knows she wasn't wrong. Bare floorboards, the room shrouded in darkness, layers of newspaper covering the windows. But unlike the first, it's stuffed to the brim. Shelves are positioned floor to ceiling, creating a maze of books and belongings. Articles are stuck on whatever walls are visible, fluttering slightly in the new breeze from the open door. It smells of dust and neglect, a faint odour of stale sweat and fried foods. They walk in slowly, hands by their sides. Even with her full suit on, Kara is reluctant to touch anything. She squints at the titles on the bookshelf. Grey's Anatomy, Simpson's Forensic Medicine, an introduction to crime scene forensics. She leaves them, going deeper into the room. The back wall was once wallpapered. Through the gaps in the newspaper, she can see tiny red roses where some of it remains. She reads the headlines. 5 murdered in sandbanks, and prostitute found dead. Clippings from his previous kills. There are spaces where the plaster has fallen away. She scuffs her feet in some of it on the floor. There's one chair, brown broken leather, positioned in front of an old bulky television. And left on the arm, reflecting in sunshine from a corner of the window, is an empty, clear pint glass. She takes a quick breath in, crouching down and peering at it in the dim light. She can see markings on the rim. The perfect semicircle of a lip impression, and 5 precise fingerprints.
"You're fucking kidding me," Griffin says from behind her. She glances backwards at him.
"Could it be this easy?" she mutters, and he gives her an incredulous look. "Fetch an SOCO from next door," she says. "Let's get it logged and analysed as soon as possible." He leaves and she continues looking around the room. She scans the shelves, pulls out one cardboard box. It doesn't have a lid. Inside she can see leather straps, silver buckles, huge purple dildos. She gingerly takes something out with 2 fingers of her gloved hand. It's what seems to be some sort of cat-o'-nine-tails, black leather, dried matter down one of the strands. She puts the box back quickly. She continues her journey. Piles of newspapers, pornography stacked neatly. She picks up one of the magazines closest to her and immediately regrets it. The woman is wearing black leather bondage gear, a ball gag in her red lipsticked mouth, tied to the bed on all fours, some sort of metal bar keeping her legs apart. She assumes it's been staged, but, realising with a jolt that it might not be, suppresses the bile rising in her stomach. This guy likes it rough and non-consensual. But they knew that, she tells herself. Why is this a surprise? Why is any of this a surprise anymore? But then she turns a corner around one of the bookshelves, and that's when she sees them. Small white frames, completely covering the wall on the far side, neatly organised in rows. Kara walks closer. They're Polaroid photos. Blurry images, but unmistakable. People. Bodies. Limbs. Blood. Kara's hand goes to her mouth. She's seen death before, but this isn't it. She feels Griffin come back into the room and stop behind her. She knows he's scanning the wall, looking at the same images she's seeing. She hears a noise, almost a groan, caught in the back of her throat, and she realises it's coming from her. Because these aren't Polaroids of dead bodies. These people are alive. These are eyes, looking at the camera, pleading, suffering, dying. These are people being tortured, captured on film for the entertainment of a killer. And one of them is her own brother.
Chapter 35.
"I don't remember a camera," Griffin whispers next to her. She turns to him. "Stop looking, Nate." She tries to push him backwards, but he doesn't budge. "Please, this isn't something you should see." At last, he turns.
"Just tell me," he says quietly. "Is Mia there?"
She scans the wall. She recognises some of the victims. She remembers the girls from the Kemper Ford Galaxy. And here they are, alive. She can make out the metal of a car door. The girl is turned away, her hands in front of her. It's out of focus, but Kara can see bloody skin, the holes in the girl's chest. She can't comprehend how this guy can control someone at the same time as stabbing them. Yet here is the evidence. She knows these are his souvenirs, the wall he goes back to enjoy what he's done over and over again. But then she stops.
"Kara?"
"Yes, Nate. I'm sorry. She's here." He turns back, sees the photo Kara's looking at. It's Mia, her hands tied, the photo taken from above. One eye is already blackened and swollen, the other looks up, full of tears. Griffin goes to take it from the wall, to hide it from plain sight. But she stops him.
I'm sorry, Nate. It's evidence.
She knows he's strong enough to overpower her and take it anyway, but instead he turns and storms away. She runs after him, out of the flat, past his discarded crime scene suit on the ground, catching up with him in the stairwell. She grabs his hand, but he shakes her off.
Leave me alone, Kara, he says.
His shoulders are slumped.
Please, just do your job. Catch this bastard.
He walks away from her, slower this time, and she lets him go. It doesn't take long for the scene of crime officers to descend. They work fast, cataloguing evidence, taking photographs. Kara can't bear to go back to the wall, so she starts to look at what else is in the room. A tattered hardback of James and the Giant Peach.
A whole shelf of medical textbooks, biographies on Dharma, Bundy, Manson, Fred West, the GSK.
She pulls one down. Post-it notes mark specific pages, and she opens it up, looking at the pencil marks highlighting passages of text. Lift torso to drain blood, she reads. Head in saucepan of water, eyeballs boil away, flesh takes longer. He's done his research. And he's done it well. She moves on. Two Polaroid cameras, the sort beloved of retro-seeking millennials. Smudges of something that looks like blood, clear on the brightly coloured plastic. Boxes of film. Notebooks of all shapes and sizes. She opens one. A piece of newspaper flutters out and Kara leans down, picking it up from the floor. The headline? Animal killer still at large. She replaces it back in the notebook and looks at some of the text on the page. It's childish handwriting. Scribbles in capitals. She tries to read it, but she can't make out the words. They need to get some floodlights in here. She can't see a bloody thing. Kara waves to a crime scene tech. Can we get this lot logged first? She asks, and they nod. There are shelves and shelves of them. Who knows what's written on their pages? The pint glass has already been taken away, a rush put on the analysis. Among all the chaos, Deakin arrives. She recognises his posture in the white suit and watches him as he walks up to the wall of Polaroids. She leaves him to it and crouches down to the VHS player below the television. She hasn't seen one like this in years, and picks up a video left on top. After the Polaroid photos, she has a bad feeling about the tape. And the rows of others behind. Kara? She turns towards Deakin. He points to the photographs.
Do we know if there's anyone here we haven't found? He asks,
and she walks up to join him.
Not that I can tell. Might help us identify the Dharma victims.
He turns back, facing the wall. She stands next to him. They look at the little white squares together. Her attention stops on one. It's a man, bare-chested, smiling, willingly posing for the camera.
She recognises the kitchen in the background. It's the Dharma flat.
She wonders how long this man lived after this photograph was taken. Why didn't you tell me you were coming here? Deakin speaks quietly. She looks at him. After a moment, he turns towards her, but in the white suit and mask, she can only see his eyes. She can't tell his expression. Kara doesn't answer. Without acknowledging it, she had wanted to put distance between her and Noah. Something last night felt like it had strayed into unknown territory. But seeing his confusion now, she knew she'd been wrong. She should have brought her partner with her. She shouldn't have risked Griffin being here. And now her brother had seen the unimaginable and he had gone God knows where. I'm sorry, Deeks. I wasn't thinking. He nods, a small movement, and her transgression is forgiven. And the moment is interrupted as a voice calls for their attention from the far side of the room. They both go over. Oh, fuck, Noah mutters. It's a large chest freezer. I'm never going to look at white domestic appliances in the same way again, Kara says. Go on then, open it. They all crane forward, ready for what they're about to see. But when the SOCO pulls the lid up, it's empty. Kara breathes a sigh of relief. Then her mobile rings. A loud break in the stillness, making her jump. She looks at the screen. It's Griffin.
Boss,
he says. And with that one word, she knows it's business.
We need you. There's been another one.
Chapter 36. Jess flits between channels on the television. Next to her, the laptop shows the BBC News. Like the true crime programmes she watched in the past, she's addicted to finding out more about this case. She watches the coverage of the press conferences from the day before again, this time looking closely at DCI Kara Elliott, Griffin's sister. She can see the resemblance, the height, the confidence, the intense expression. The Echo Man, she repeats to herself quietly. It feels strange that the reason she's met Griffin is due to this killer. He killed Mia. He killed Patrick. A dark truth that bonds them. She stretches and feels the skin on her back tense, then crack. She reaches around and tentatively touches the scab, skin destroyed from being pushed up against the wall by Griffin. He's been gone all day. They haven't spoken about last night, about what they did, about what she told him. For that, she's grateful. She's not sure what she thinks about it all, what she thinks about him. She knows there are things he's not telling her, and same with her, but she trusts him. More than she's trusted anyone for a long time. She picks up Griffin's laptop, flicking around other news sites, looking for updates, but it seems they're not reporting anything new. Then her fingers hesitate over the keys. She's never been a big one for social media, but now she's apart from her daughter, she needs some connection. She needs to see her face. She opens up Facebook. She ignores the usual banality and meaningless jabber of so-called friends and clicks on her personal page, selecting the Photos tab. There's not much there, but it's enough. Alice. She clicks on the thumbnail of one of the most recent. It's a selfie, from a walk at the beach, sun shining in the background. Jess is laughing. Alice has her face close to the camera, too close, her nose wrinkled, her deliciously chubby cheeks red and healthy. Jess remembers that day. It had just been the two of them, free to wander and do as they pleased without Patrick's watchful glare. Jess goes back, then scrolls down to the earlier photos. Alice as a baby, just born, lying peacefully in Jess's arms. Jess seems half awake, bloated, blotchy, but Alice's gaze is fixed on her face. It's always been that way, as if through her daughter's eyes, her mother can do no wrong. Jess knows her daughter is flawless, a mother's blinkered prerogative. But contrary to the rest of the world, Alice has only ever thought her mother is perfect. Jess feels tears threaten and she clicks away. Now here's Nav, holding baby Alice, beaming like a proud father. She remembers Nav posted this picture on Facebook himself. The comments underneath from adoring women were quite something to behold. She took the piss at the time, which Nav took with his customary good grace. But his devotion towards Alice has never changed. Jess wondered what would happen if he got married, had children of his own. As if sensing her thoughts, the laptop bings and a message appears from the bottom right of the screen. Navin Sharma, it says. Then, where are you? With a jolt, she realises the computer must have flagged she's online, and she shuts the laptop lid quickly. How could she have been so stupid? If Nav saw it, what if the police had too? What if they tracked her back here? She remembers the last time. She remembers the fear, the uncertainty. Being bundled into the back of a police car, her hands cuffed behind her back. The blood. The tears. Patrick shouting. The flashing lights of the ambulance. But there's nowhere else for her to go this time. Nowhere else to run.
She shuts off the television and the lights. She sits in the darkness, in silence. And she waits.
Chapter 37. The rain pours in sheets, flooding the roads. The car sends up great plumes of water as Kara drives, her foot flat to the floor. Griffin had been vague about details on the phone. Two dead. Shot. Immediately she'd put a call into Shenton. If this is their killer, she wants to know the details straight away. Of which sick fucker he's emulating. She hopes Shenton knows as much as he says he does. He's escalating. The kills are coming faster now. "There, there!" Deakin shouts, pointing to a gap in the trees, and Kara turns quickly. The car bumps up the dirt track. "Sultan's Hill," he says. "Local beauty spot, known to attract hikers during the day and people wanting a bit of alone time at night." Kara can see the vehicles now. Two patrol cars and a white van. SOCO have made it there before them, but only just. Through the gaps in the wipers, she can see people hastily erecting a white tent, desperate to protect the crime scene from the torrential rain. Deakin opens the door, and Kara follows him around to the boot. They change out of their shoes into Wellingtons, and Deakin gets out an umbrella, putting it up over them. Kara pulls the hood up on her head. She watches a crime scene officer run past them in the opposite direction. They seem to be crying. She sees Griffin standing, lit in the headlights. He doesn't have any sort of waterproof on, just the collar of his black coat pulled up over his chin, his usual black boots on his feet. "What have we got?" Kara shouts over the din of the rain.
"Two dead. One male, one female."
He points to the car on the far side. Both front doors are open, the right window smashed.
"Male is halfway out of the car, shot in the head. The female..."
He points down the path.
"Seems to have been trying to escape. Shot in the back. We have multiple sets of tyre tracks at the scene. SOCO trying to get some preserved before we lose them all in this rain."
She nods pointedly to Deakin, and he hands her the umbrella, then heads over to the car. Kara's phone rings and she answers it.
"Shenton," she says. "What can you tell me?" "I haven't had long to look at this," he starts, hesitantly. "But from what Griffin has told me..."
He stops and Kara waits impatiently.
"Couple dead, shot. You're either looking at Berkowitz or the Zodiac killer."
He pauses.
"My best guess is Zodiac, because Berkowitz never actually killed both a man and a woman in a couple."
"Tell me more," she says. Griffin stands next to her, taking shelter under her umbrella, and she puts the phone on speaker.
"Zodiac killer, active in the 60s and 70s, never found." Shenton carries on. "Estimated to have killed 7 victims, but some sources say up to 37. Most either shot or stabbed."
Kara's attention is diverted by raised voices over to her left. She looks across. Deakin is shouting, arguing with a crime scene tech. She hangs up the phone and goes over. Deakin sees her from a distance and stops. He holds out his arms.
"Don't go over there, Kara," he says.
The look on his face makes her freeze. He's upset, but this isn't the usual hard anger from seeing a dead body. The rain is running down his face and he seems on the edge of tears. She looks past him, into the trees.
"What are you shouting about?"
"I wanted..."
He pauses, looks down, gathering himself together.
"I wanted to go over, make sure she's dead. I thought we could still help her, but..."
"But Deeks, they've already checked. They would have made sure."
She starts, but her voice trails off. She continues to stare over Deakin's shoulder and takes a step towards the body. He holds out his arm, stopping her from walking further. She's seen something. Something that pulls at her subconscious. But it couldn't be. Her phone rings again and she answers it, still staring at the woman's body.
"Boss, the lab called."
It's Shenton again.
"The prints on the pint glass from flat 214 came back."
He has her attention now. "And?"
"Well..."
He pauses.
"Hit
on the system to someone called Elizabeth Roberts. She works in the lab. Yes, I know. Kara stops. She looks at Deakin, and she sees it confirmed in his eyes. She takes another step.
Don't go over there, Kara.